It's Friday, April 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a South African court will review a corruption ruling against President Jacob Zuma.
People are saying now it is plain clear that President Zuma is not fit to be the president of this country.
The World Bank says millions of new apparel jobs can be created in South Asia. And the late singer Prince left no will to his million-dollar estate. It's all ahead. A judge in South Africa on Friday said a 2009 court decision to drop nearly 800 corruption charges against President Jacob Zuma was irrational and called for the case to be re-examined. The court decision Friday is likely to increase calls for Zuma's resignation from even some within his ruling African National Congress Party, which started last month following a separate court ruling against the embattled leader. I spoke with reporter Tuso Khumalo in Johannesburg about the corruption ruling.
In a normal situation now, what we expect is for President Zuma to step down, but indications are that he is not going to step down. But the Democratic Alliance, which is the main opposition party, is the one that took this case to court saying those charges were not supposed to be dropped. So now that the court has given them a right to pursue those charges, they will pursue the charges with the NPA to make sure those charges are reinstated. What this means is that now Zuma is going to go back to court to face those corruption charges that involved a lot of things that he did even before he became a president. So we expect the NPA to implement the court decision by reinstating the judges, the charges, and calling Zuma to court to answer to those charges.
Has President Zuma made any official response to this ruling?
At the moment, President Zuma has not made a response to the ruling, but indications are that he may appeal. But what we have heard is the ruling party spokesperson, Zizi Gordwa, who said, as far as they see this verdict, the judge did not pronounce that Zuma is guilty. He did not pronounce that Zuma is corrupt, but he only pronounced on that the charges should be reinstated. So according to him, there is no decision, there's no reason why they should be worried. There's no reason why they should recall Zuma now, because what it means is that the charges will be reinstated in court and Zuma will appear in court. And it is only when a verdict has been made that, according to him, the ANC will decide on what to do. But at the moment, no response from Zuma, but all indications are that he's going to appeal.
There are a number of charges against the President Zuma, but including there was a lot of controversy involving work that Zuma had done on his residence, his private residence. What was involved there?
Zuma is, at the moment, a lot of people and legal experts have called this a legal blow, one after the other. What happened is that there was a security upgrade that was supposed to happen at Zuma's home, Inkandla home, and that was done, and a lot of money was used, up to 249 million rands, calculated at that time to be around $16 million. And the public prosecutor investigated that and discovered that too much funds were used that were not supposed to be. Structures that were not for security reasons were constructed, and he asked and directed that Zuma should pay back that amount. But Zuma, instead of implementing those recommendations from the public protector, what he did, he set up committees of ministerial committees to reinvestigate that. And those committees exonerated him and said he's not supposed to pay anything. And this DA and another opposition party called Economic Freedom Fighters, they went to court to force Zuma to pay back and to implement those decisions. And it is that recent court decision which ruled that Zuma violated the constitution by not listening to the public protector to pay back the money. And this is that came on Friday today, comes at the foot of the one that also found him guilty of violating the constitution in the case of the construction that happened at his home.
And generally, I know this has just happened today on Friday, but what has been the reaction? I mean, I'm sure this is huge news in South Africa. What has been the reaction among the media and other segments of South Africa's population to this?
This has generated a lot of anger. You'd know that on the 27th in this country, it was a Freedom Day. but you had groups of people, hundreds of people, who instead of celebrating South Africa's 25th anniversary as a democratic country, they gathered in different places calling for Zuma to go, saying Zuma must fall because of the corruption charges, because of the rulings against him from the Constitutional Court. So this has added to that pain or to those calls again. People are saying now it is plain clear that President Zuma is not fit to be the president of this country. He continues to embarrass the country and his party and everybody else. So they feel it is time for Zuma to go. But unfortunately, for Zuma to go, his party has to be convinced he has to go, because that decision has to be taken in parliament, unfortunately, which of which ANC has the majority. They protected him in the constitutional court ruling, where he was found to have violated the constitution. And any attempts by the opposition now on these corruption charges, it might also face that. But the difference now is he's now facing corruption charges. And corruption charges are different from the recommendations of the party protector. So we expect the court might rule that he goes to jail or something happens, of which, when speaking to experts, they are saying it might take time because Zuma is going to appeal and it takes years again. So these charges may be reinstated at a time when he's no longer a president at all. So all efforts and indications from people that he must go, but if you look on the ground, it's not likely that he's going to go before his term expires.
That's reporter Tuso Komalo in Johannesburg. Well, now for reaction on social media, I'm joined by editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's the reaction to all this?
Well, we're seeing hashtag Zuma and hashtag spy tapes both trending as this news breaks, but a lot of what we're seeing on social media is people saying no one is above the law. Even if you're the leader of a country, and especially if you're the leader of a country, you should be held to a high standard. So there's a lot of praise for these investigators, praise for this court for coming down with this ruling, and a lot of caution, waiting to see what happens, how this has played out. People noting this has played out for well over a decade, and it could continue to play out into the future. So there's a lot of uncertainty, but a lot of, I would say, hope that justice will prevail for a lot of people who think that President Zuma needs to be held accountable.
Mm-hmm. What else is trending?
We have a story out of the U.S. Where Snapchat could be held liable for a car accident. Now, this young woman, Crystal McGee, she was driving and she was using Snapchat. And Snapchat has this filter where it shows how fast you're traveling. And she was trying to see in her car, well, let me see how fast I can go. We're using this filter. Well, she got up to 113 miles per hour in a 55 mile per hour zone, ended up hitting a car and severely injuring a man. And that man, Maynard Wentworth, and his wife are now suing not only Crystal McGee, but Snapchat, saying that Snapchat should be liable because of this speed filter that they put on there, that they should have known that this could cause people to intentionally speed to try to get that number up on that filter. It opens up a lot of doors as to whether social media can be held liable. There have been questions in the past on whether cell phone companies can be held liable if people are texting while driving, if they don't take measures to stop that. And there have been campaigns to ask people not to text while drive. So it'd be interesting to see if social media now has campaigns, don't use social media while driving, or use social media cautiously, or maybe they think about what they're trying to put out there instead of trying to encourage people to go fast or putting these filters out there that might do those kind of things. So we'll see how this plays out, but it could be a new frontier for social media in the legal world.
Absolutely. Remember to keep your eyes on the road when you're
Absolutely.
Driving.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much. That's Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Out in the far reaches of our solar system lies the Kuiper Belt. This region of space is occupied by icy objects left over from the creation of the solar system. Several dwarf planets, such as Pluto, also occupy the Kuiper Belt. Astronomers studying images gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope in 2015 say that they have found a dark and tiny moon circling the dwarf planet of Makemake, the smaller sister of Pluto. Makemake, discovered in 2005, was named after a deity worshipped by the Rapa Nui people of Easter Island. This newfound moon, the first companion to the dwarf planet that's ever been seen, has been nicknamed MK2. Its diameter is estimated to be about 260 kilometers across and was found orbiting Makemake at a distance of about 21,000 kilometers. Astronomers will further study MK2 to determine whether its orbit is elliptical or circular. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, new medical research on the body's immune system. A new World Bank study says South Asia can create millions of new jobs in the apparel industry by taking advantage of rising manufacturing costs in China. I spoke with VOA's Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi about the report's findings.
Well, you know, these countries, which is essentially India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka and Pakistan, already have an apparel sector. However, they could expand it hugely because, as everyone knows, wages in China are rising. For example, they're about $2.50 an hour. That's almost double of India and four times that of Bangladesh. So that's opening the door to competitors. South Asian countries have a huge young workforce. You know, in India alone, 1 million people enter the labor market every year. And this is a very labor-intensive industry. So these countries are ideally suited to expanding this sector in a big way. However, what the World Bank study says is so far the advantage has been seized by East Asian countries like Vietnam and Cambodia, but it is urging South Asia to do more to expand their sector as well and to get in more investment and, you know, sort of just create new jobs, as you say.
Now, though there has been a problem, particularly in Bangladesh over the last few years, where there have been building collapses, buildings that housed apparel factories, that kind of things. What kind of precautions, you know, should go into this if that industry is to expand in South Asia?
Absolutely. The conditions remain a concern. And I think the spotlight turned on them, as you say, in 2013, when, you know, the Rana Plaza building in Bangladesh collapsed and almost 1,100 people were literally buried under the rubble. There were fires also in other factories. This turned the attention to how manufacturers do not pay enough attention to safety simply because they have to be competitive. And in order to remain competitive, that's the easiest place where they can reduce costs. However, what is happening now, I think, is global retailers are under pressure also to ensure that these factories are safe. So there are accords in Bangladesh. There is a huge inspection going on at this time. The government has also agreed to oversight. And manufacturers will simply have to be more careful to see that all these concerns are met.
Anjana, how could this increase in the apparel industry, how could that help women in the workforce?
Well, you know, this is one particular sector where the number of women employed is very large compared to most other industries. And as you know, more female employment leads typically to improving not just the economic but also the overall social conditions in a country. Because when women earn, they invest more of their wages in health and education of their children. So that, I think, is where the World Bank feels and wants these countries to focus on this industry because it feels it is not just an economic advantage, it will also be in the long term a social advantage.
That's VOA's Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi. Antibiotic resistance has made infections hard to fight and in many cases life-threatening. Now researchers have found a way to harness the body's natural immune system to fight an infection without antibiotics. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Scientists in Sweden may have found an alternative to antibiotics to fight infections. In a mouse model, they've trained the body's natural immune system, called innate immunity, to disarm and destroy a bacterium that causes a kidney infection, often in children. The innate immune system is the front line of the body's defenses, and it works in two different ways to fight infections. The first is what the researchers call a good antibacterial defense that targets and kills the invading pathogen. The other part of the system causes inflammation, the redness, swelling, and fever that accompanies any illness or injury. That is also a vital part of the immune response, but can also cause significant tissue damage and in some cases contribute to the progress of the disease or infection.
And so the question has been, can you find a way of treating infections by stopping the bad part of the immune defense and still keep the antibacterial defense? This is what we have done in our model.
Katarina Svanborg is a professor of clinical immunology at Lund University in Sweden. She and her fellow researchers found that the two parts of the process are controlled by two different molecules, so they just turned off the inflammation molecule. By blocking it, they found they could take advantage of the part of natural immune defense that promotes healing.
It is a surprise because this technology has not been used in this way to treat infections. So it was an unexpected finding, but it was a logical step to take after showing that these two did different things.
Svanborg and colleagues published their findings in the journal Science Translational Medicine. She says investigators are planning more tests, this time to see if the innate immune system can take on other pathogens, like those that cause pneumonia.
The picture is the same for all these different categories. And conceptually, what we've done is to say, instead of killing the bacteria directly, we are harnessing the immune system in such a way that the tissue damage is suppressed and the symptoms are suppressed.
Given the urgency and growing seriousness of bacterial infections that don't respond to antibiotics, Svanborg thinks it's only a matter of time before some illnesses are treated using the immune system alone. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This International Edition. A week has passed since music icon Prince died at his home near the U.S. city of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And now some information has begun to trickle out about his death, plus more. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald about it all.
The world still mourns the loss of Prince, but we have learned a few things about him. And one of the interesting things is he did not leave a will, but he left an awful lot of stuff.
He sure did. Hey, Jim, this is partly owing to his deep-seated distrust of contracts. He had terrible experiences with record labels. He famously wrote the word slave on his cheek in the 1990s when he was battling with Warner Brothers Records. Now, on Tuesday, his sister Tyka Nelson filed an emergency motion to have an administrator gather and protect Prince's assets. Bremer Bank has been appointed to fill that role. Prince was married twice, and he and his wife, Maytay, suffered some miscarriages. But as far as we know, he does not have any surviving children. Now, the trust also needs to locate Prince's heirs, and as of now, they include Tyka and five half-siblings. Lawyers who handle intellectual property say it may take years to determine the value of Prince's estate, and we, the public, may never hear about it. Right now, it's estimated to be worth well in excess of $100 million. People have thrown various figures around, up to and including $300 million. Prince worked with many lawyers, accountants, and business managers over the years, and this just further complicates the process. He would apparently drop them at the slightest pretext and then have somebody else sign up. So there are a lot of channels that this has to go through.
It's really fascinating. The songs in the vault, we understand there are quite a few, and we could end up, once they get this sorted out, with Prince albums coming out for years to come.
It may well be a Jimi Hendrix-type situation where there were several posthumous albums issued. He was very prolific. He released 39 albums over the course of his 38-year recording career, and apparently he has hundreds more songs in the vaults. And so their worth will depend on when and how they're released. That's the latest on Prince's estate situation. Meanwhile, a law enforcement official told CNN that authorities found prescription opioid medication in Prince's possession and at his home. They want to determine who prescribed the pills and if they were improperly prescribed. Entertainment Tonight is reporting that Prince used the pain medication Percocet to treat hip and ankle pain beginning in 2006. He underwent hip replacement surgery in 2010. Prince was 5'2", and he frequently wore high-heeled shoes. And his former fiancée and musical collaborator Sheila E. remarked that he was in constant pain because he would often jump from stage risers during his concerts. And this put tremendous pressure on his ankles and hips. And so apparently Prince lived his later years in constant pain, and that must have been just horrible.
Always with us is Ray McDonald, our Top 20 Countdown host. You can follow him on Twitter at Ray on the Hits. And Ray, they can join you every week for the Countdown at
VOA1.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Jim.
The music of Prince. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and please have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the release of the State Department's annual country reports on human rights, which document human rights conditions in 177 countries, including Iran, Assistant Secretary of State of the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Tom Malinowski, noted that the reports come at a time when authoritarian governments are striking out with particular ferocity against the freedoms of expression, association, and the press. The report on Iran notes severe restrictions on civil liberties, including the freedoms of assembly, association, speech, including via the Internet, religion, and press. It also cites limitations on citizens' ability to choose their government through free and fair elections, abuse of due process with escalating use of capital punishment for crimes that do not meet international minimum standards of most serious crimes, arbitrary detention, politically motivated violence and repression, harsh prison conditions, discrimination against women, ethnic and religious minorities, as well as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex persons. The human rights reports contain numerous examples of rights abuses from around the world. In Iran, they include the case of labor activist Shahrokh Zamani, who died in custody in Rajai Shahr prison, of the deteriorating medical condition of journalist and human rights activist Narges Mohammadi, who has been charged with propaganda against the state and assembly and collusion against national security, of the forced virginity test of imprisoned cartoonist and activist Atena Farag Dhani, originally sentenced to 12 years for such crimes as spreading propaganda and insulting members of parliament. In an interview with the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that when President Hassan Rouhani was elected, the Iranian people had high expectations because of his promises to improve human rights and the rule of law. Unfortunately, we have not seen significant changes, said Mr. Malinowski.
One constant through this is that the Iranian people want to live in a more normal country. They have said that to their own government and to the international community every chance that they have had.
Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that the nuclear agreement between the P5 plus one countries and Iran has raised hopes for greater normality in the future. But true normality is only going to come, he said, if the Iranian government rights its relationship with its own people through respect for law, respect for human rights, respect for those international norms which are important in Iran and everywhere in the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.